From Foreign Policy, I'm Sarah Wildman, and this is First Person. This week, the death of Mohamed Morsi and the future of the Muslim Brotherhood. On June 17th, former Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi collapsed and died while on trial in Cairo.
State media reports a 67-year-old suffered a heart attack during a court hearing. He was facing charges in an espionage case.
Mohamed Morsi was a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, a movement founded some 90 years ago that gradually gained broad support across the Arab world. He became Egypt's first democratically elected president in 2012 at the height of the Arab Spring.
It was a remarkable moment as thunderous cheers filled Cairo's Tahrir Square on Sunday, and thousands of supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood, a party that had been officially outlawed for decades, celebrated the election of one of their own, Mohamed Morsi, as president of Egypt.
But his tenure didn't last long. In 2013, Morsi was ousted in a military coup led by General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, who then carried out a sweeping crackdown on the Muslim Brotherhood. Morsi had been in prison ever since.
When asked whether the Brotherhood would cease to exist during his presidency, Sisi said, yes, that's right. It's not me that finished it. The Egyptians have. The problem is not...
President Trump hosted General Sisi in the White House earlier this year. Since then, he's considered designating the Muslim Brotherhood a terrorist organization. Shadi Hamid has written extensively about the Muslim Brotherhood and interviewed Morsi himself. He's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and the author of the book Islamic Exceptionalism, How the Struggle Over Islam is Reshaping the World. Shadi, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So you actually knew Mohamed Morsi.
The first time I met him was May 8th, 2010. That was our first interview. And then I met him, I think, a couple times after that, including after the Arab Spring, after the revolution, so-called revolution in retrospect. And it was interesting because when I met him that first time, I would have never dreamed that someone like him would become president. I mean, that's not – he was seen more as a functionary, not someone with big ideas or particularly charismatic. He wasn't charismatic. But a kind of loyal enforcer, a kind of good Muslim Brotherhood official, got things done, but wasn't particularly well known to the media, certainly not very well known in the West. So I think that, you know, fast forward a little bit to 2011, but actually 2012 when he was elected president. And it's just an amazing reversal of fortune from where Morsi and the Brotherhood were in 2010 when I first met him, to where they ended up.
Let's actually go back. Let's look at the beginning of the Muslim Brotherhood, founded with Hassan al-Banna in the 20s. What was it founded as?
The Brotherhood was founded in Egypt in 1928, so it's been around for quite some time now. It was talking about building a more Islamic society from the bottom up, that you would start with individuals. And once the individual reformed him or herself, that would lead to better Muslim families. Better Muslim families would lead to better communities, and that would rise indirectly over time to the top layers of society, including eventually in government. So in that sense, they were gradualist par excellence. They weren't rushing. They weren't calling for revolution. They were steady as you go. And that's always been, I think, the Brotherhood's strength, but also its weakness, that it has been an incredibly gradualist and also pragmatic organization.
But it's associated in the 40s and 50s with violence. Why?
Yeah. So starting in the 1940s, there were some instances of violence, the most prominent among them, the assassination of the prime minister at the time, Prime Minister Nakrashi, in 1948, and then the attempted assassination of Gamal Abdel Nasser in 1954. Most of the evidence that we have suggests that in both cases, it was rogue members of the Brotherhood, or to put it a little bit differently, Brotherhood members were involved, but the senior leadership did not authorize, or in some cases wasn't even aware of these instances of violence. And the Brotherhood historically, even in the few moments where it did try to use violence, it wasn't good at using violence. That's never been its strong point, let's say.
Why did the state crack down on them then if it wasn't about violence?
So in its first few years, starting in 1928, they were focused on preaching and religious outreach and hearts and minds, if you will. Starting about in the mid-30s, they start to take more political stances. They were against the status quo. They didn't like the way things were. And they wanted Egypt, the nature of the state and the nature of Egyptian identity, to change. And that is going to be a fundamental challenge to existing authorities in almost any kind of circumstance. And keep in mind, at this point, there was still a British-backed monarchy that saw any kind of mass movement. And the Brotherhood was precisely that, a mass movement. We're not talking about a vanguard or a small group of ideologically committed individuals. We're talking about an organization that really had an ambition to spread throughout society. So at its peak in the 1940s, estimates range from 500,000 to 1 million members. And at this point, Egypt in the 40s had about 20 million people. So this is like a massive proportion of the overall population. So this was a real and a really successful mass movement.
Who are they drawn from?
There is a perception often that the Brotherhood draws support from the poor and the destitute. That hasn't necessarily been the case, especially if we look at the early decades of the Brotherhood. We see their base and their strongest levels of support among middle-class professionals and lower middle-class to some extent. People who wanted to get ahead and had some level of education, but maybe were frustrated in those ambitions. But we're talking about doctors, engineers, lawyers, teachers, people who were part of this more urbanized class that was emerging. And that also made them quite effective because they were drawing on a lot of expertise within their membership.
The Brotherhood did renounce violence in the late 60s,
yeah, I think, look, the major criticism, at least from the anti-Brotherhood folks, violence didn't tend to come up as much, in part because there wasn't much. You'd literally have to, like, fabricate violence. The Brotherhood wasn't actually doing that in the 2000s or the 1990s. They renounced violence in the early 70s. It was much more about the Brotherhood having mass support and doing well in elections. There was definitely this fear that the Brotherhood, because it could use religion and religious rhetoric effectively, that it would somehow trick the masses into voting for the Brotherhood. Politics in Egypt during and after the Arab Spring became existential. They were debating the very nature of the state, what it meant to be Egyptian. Mm-hmm. And that's like the most raw existential thing that you can possibly imagine. And my relatives would tell me this explicitly. Shadi, you come here with your pro-democracy ideals, and they're nice in theory, but we're the ones who have to live with the consequences of elections.
You spent a number of years interviewing members of the Muslim Brotherhood across Egypt and Jordan, and the Arab Spring begins, and you're in Tahrir Square. Take us there with you.
I wasn't there by accident. I flew to Egypt to kind of witness what was going on, but also to conduct interviews. I wanted specifically to understand the Muslim Brotherhood's role in the protests, because there was a lot of debate around it. Is the Muslim Brotherhood like a Trojan horse? Like, what are they trying to be? They're being very quiet about their involvement, but then they're going to be ready to kind of strike and take over. I mean, those fears about the Brotherhood's involvement were there from the very beginning, and the Brotherhood was careful to diminish its role or to at least de-emphasize its role in its public statements, because the era of Mubarak formally ended on February 11th, 2011. And so we can sort of mark that as when the revolution really happened. And I was in Tahrir Square when the announcement that Mubarak was stepping down was made. And it was literally one of the most beautiful moments I've experienced. It's really hard to describe. It's not very common, I don't think, for to be in a revolution and to actually see it happen in real time. It started off as a murmur in the square. Then it just kept on building into this wall of sound, and it just kind of erupted into this roar. Egyptians everywhere were dancing in the streets. There was a joy, because that's what freedom feels like when you haven't felt it. So there was a beauty to the whole thing, and I feel very blessed to have witnessed it. But that's what makes the subsequent events to me utterly heartbreaking. It's become harder to remember what it felt like to be there.
Did you have a sense from people in the street in those first nights of what they hoped to see come next?
No one knew the details about the political order that they wanted. And at that point, people weren't really talking about the role of Islamic law. People were too joyful to get into these very contentious debates that Egyptians have been struggling with really since independence in 1952. But in those early days, there was a lot of talk about unity, of the brotherhood and secularists and liberals and leftists coming together and there being a pro-revolutionary coalition.
Did you have a sense then that the Muslim Brotherhood was recalibrating its own strategy of incrementalism?
At first, in the first few months, they were pretty careful. But I'm not someone who believes in the narrative that the Brotherhood knew its designs from the very first moment and was just waiting for the right moment. It was really surprising that this revolution happened. And even if we backtrack a few months before February 2011, there were elections and parliamentary elections, and they were probably the least free in decades. And the crackdown was worsening. Political space was closing. November 2010 felt like this was the worst a lot of us had ever seen it. So to go from that feeling of like despair, and that's what pretty much everyone in the Brotherhood that I was talking to in 2010 was telling me, this is done. There's no hope with Mubarak. It's this total repression, total authoritarianism. It's closed. Then for the revolution to happen just a short period afterwards, the Brotherhood wasn't in that state of mind to even think about what it would look like to govern.
Who did you set about trying to talk to in the weeks after the revolution within the Brotherhood and beyond it?
I always made an effort to talk to Brotherhood youth, so people who weren't particularly well known, but were interesting interlocutors in the sense that they were maybe people my age, sometimes quite a bit younger, people who are still in college, and they could sometimes be some of the most interesting because they didn't have history to weigh them down. They're more open and they share things about internal divisions, about things that they're not comfortable with. So I always tried to balance my interviews in that way, but also just spending time with my family in the months after the revolution to get a sense. And one thing I definitely sensed early on was discomfort. Many of them were like, we'll go along with the revolution. We weren't like fully on board in the first place. It happened. We accept that it happened. But there was a sense of fear. A fear that things would change.
And at which point did you see that Morsi himself begins to kind of emerge as who will be the leader to run in elections?
So going into late 2011, going into early 2012, things start to get a little bit chaotic. Mm-hmm. And what I think all of us saw at that time was there was a vacuum. There weren't other parties or factions that were particularly well organized besides the Muslim Brotherhood and to a lesser extent, certain Salafi, in other words, ultra-conservative parties to the right of the Brotherhood. So the people who were dominating the political space were disproportionately Islamists, and liberals and leftists were really struggling to get organized and to build parties. And that led to this sense that because there was this vacuum, the Brotherhood felt that it had to play more of a lead role and kind of come out of the shadows, or it wouldn't just be one party among many, it would become the dominant party. The Brotherhood had a built-in political advantage because they weren't just a political party. They weren't even primarily a political party. They were a movement. They could draw on a certain level of grassroots networks, but also I think that they started to feel more and more threatened by the military, that the military was making moves that basically undermined aspects of the democratic transition. And it wasn't clear how willing the military was when it came to giving up power. Mm-hmm. And there were very key moments where a lot of us as observers and researchers weren't sure what the military was going to do. And in 2012, the democratically elected parliament was dissolved by a judicial decree. And that's where this term, the deep state, comes from. It comes from... well before that, but that's when the term was starting to be used again a lot in the context of Egypt's transition, that there was this deep state combining military, intelligence, police, but also the courts that were basically trying to undermine the democratic transition. The Brotherhood saw that and they said, we can't let this happen. We have to be more at the forefront and do whatever we can to keep this deep state at bay.
So that means speeding up and moving away from their policies of incrementalism.
Ahead of themselves and being tempted by the temptations of power.
Did you have a sense at the time of specific men emerging as leaders of the Brotherhood.
Morsi becomes more prominent after the revolution.
And who is he? Where does he come from? What's his backstory?
So out of senior Brotherhood leaders, he's probably the one who spent the most time in the U.S. He got his Ph.D. in California. I think one or two of his sons are U.S. citizens because they were born there. And he's someone who did have a lot of familiarity with aspects of maybe not a lot, but at least some because he had lived there, which actually led him to have a pretty strong cultural critique of American morals in a way that I felt maybe other Brotherhood officials didn't always emphasize. But he would draw on his experience in the U.S. and say, well, I saw that aspect of American culture and this kind of moral collapse, that sort of thing. He was also aware of certain like pop culture tropes. I remember in one interview that we did, and actually I did a profile of Morsi in Foreign Policy. It's called Brother Number One, where I talk about some of this, but he would make references to movies. He also did a Jimmy Carter impression. You know, he wasn't this insular Egyptian Islamist leader who doesn't know what's going on in the world. I mean, he wasn't particularly worldly. He was an engineer by training. And I think in some sense, he had a narrow lens through which he saw politics, unlike some other Brotherhood leaders who were a little bit more learned in political theory and Islamic theology. That was never Morsi's strong point. And so when I say he was a kind of loyalist enforcer, apparatchik kind of figure, that's what he was good at doing. He wasn't a big strategic thinker.
Did you have a chance to meet with him again as he was running and clearly seemed to be emerging out of the pack?
So he wasn't actually supposed to be the Brotherhood's presidential candidate. So in some sense, he was the accidental president. The main person, he was somewhat mysterious. His name was Khayrat al-Shater, a millionaire businessman in Egypt. He had ideas, but he also had money. And he was supposed to be the first presidential candidate, but he was disqualified on controversial technical grounds. So Morsi was the replacement candidate. And people made fun of Morsi, and some people would call him like the spare tire candidate or something like that, because there was a sense like, why Morsi? And I think a lot of people were confused. That said, the Brotherhood is strong as an organization, as an internal bureaucracy. They're not strong when it comes to charismatic individuals, at least not since their founder, Hassan al-Banna, who was extremely charismatic. It's the Brotherhood's weakness, but it's also in some sense a strength because you don't want to be too dependent on one or two particularly charismatic individuals. They always emphasize the organization. That's where it became, I think, very problematic for the Brotherhood because that prevented them from adapting to difficult situations. They seemed so intent on their own self-preservation that leftists and liberals after the revolution started to suspect that the Brotherhood was just in it for itself and that whenever it was between the good of the revolution and the preservation of the Brotherhood as an organization, the Brotherhood always seemed to err on the side of the latter. That led to a major breach in the so-called revolutionary coalition. Mm-hmm. And that put the military in a very strong position once it decided to end the revolution.
So in 2012, Morsi is elected. Was there a sense of divide in the population that you saw in terms of pro and anti-Morsi supporters?
Yes, I saw hatred and polarization that I think a lot of us felt was quite frightening in the year that Morsi was in power.
And that hatred and polarization is between Islamists and liberals? It's between the Brotherhood and others? Who is it between?
I would say more broadly, it's between Islamists and non-Islamists. Now, non-Islamists can be nationalists, they can be liberals. Mm-hmm. They can be leftists, and not all of them started to hate the Brotherhood, but many of them did. So from elite media institutions, elite intellectuals, we start to see some pretty charged and kind of crazy anti-Muslim Brotherhood rhetoric, all these conspiracy theories about the Brotherhood, like taking over the state and selling the pyramids to God knows who, like weird stuff. And a lot of this stuff had to do with like the Zionist U.S. Brotherhood conspiracy. Obama was, according to this line of thought, a Brotherhood sympathizer and even perhaps a closet Brotherhood member himself. So people were losing their minds. It was like this mass hysteria was building. Now, it's more obvious in retrospect. At the time, we saw signs of it, but we had no idea that it would become what it became.
In 2012, you actually wrote that Morsi was unusual for presidential candidates, that he had talked about limiting his own power. Did he ever even have a chance to do that?
He talked about that. Now, in a sense, his power was already limited in that because Egypt was going through this very flawed process of democratization, even if Morsi deep down would have liked to be a dictator, his surrounding circumstances simply didn't allow him to usurp power.
So you have this hysteria, this polarization, and this fracturing. You have a revolutionary moment that's very, very joyful, and that dissipates relatively quickly. Does that set the scene for the military stepping in?
Yes. It wasn't purely manufactured by the military. There was real public opposition to the Muslim Brotherhood that was building. Keep in mind, this is also happening in a context where the economic situation is pretty bad, but also not pretty bad relative to people's expectations of what a revolution should bring. This is why revolutions are dangerous, because you think after a revolution, oh, things will get better. But when you see, it may not even be the case that your life gets that much worse. But if it stays the same and your expectations have gone up significantly, the gap is quite large.
In your book, you talk about 2011 being the beginning of the revolution and 2013, with the Rabaa massacre, being the end of it. You were in Rabaa the week before the massacre. What did you see there?
Well, so right before the coup, you have these mass protests, which were fine and legitimate. And one thing is that the Brotherhood never really had control of the police or really even the military. There were certain normal functions of government the Brotherhood didn't seem capable of, even to the extent that Brotherhood headquarters were being sacked and burned down. And you're like, wait a second, they're in power and they can't even get the police to protect their own institutions. But the June 30th protests happened, and that's what the military took advantage of. And we should be clear, not everyone who was protesting on June 30th wanted a coup. Many of them were calling for early elections or for Morsi to resign within the context of a democratic process. The military had different designs, and they saw their chance. They saw their opportunity. This didn't happen overnight. It was being built up, and the military was preparing itself for this moment. So the coup happens. The Brotherhood and Morsi are ousted from power. So I was in Egypt in the week leading up to the Rabaa massacre, which Human Rights Watch calls the worst mass killing in modern Egyptian history.
Why were people gathered there to begin with?
So the Brotherhood decided that after the coup happened, they wouldn't make the same mistake they made in 1954, when Nasser started to crack down on the Brotherhood, and the Brotherhood essentially didn't mobilize. They didn't really protest against Nasser. They thought it would pass, and as a result, they got destroyed pretty quickly. So this time around, the Brotherhood said to themselves, we're not going to do the same thing we did in 1954. We're going to be out in the streets. We're going to be trying to build popular support for our cause. They kept on insisting that Morsi was a legitimate president and that they wouldn't leave these two protest sites in Cairo until Morsi was reinstated.
And what did the protest site feel like in that week?
They thought history was on their side, as often the Brotherhood does.
Were there men and women there?
Yeah, men and
children?
Women, mixed, old, young. There was a kind of, I don't want to say like a festival, but there was a lot going on. Mm-hmm. So there was a sense of fear, but there was also a sense of optimism and activity, because they had all these makeshift stalls, like food stalls, like a makeshift pharmacy, a media center, like in the middle of the area. And they knew that the military might be willing to use some force, but they didn't think that there would be a massacre that would attempt to just eliminate them altogether. I left 2 days before the massacre happened on August 12th. Happened on August 14th. They moved in around a little bit after dawn, if I recall. And then throughout the day, they just erased the protest site. About 1,000 people were killed. I mean, just the makeshift morgues that people had to make, but also the shock, because the Brotherhood has always been more comfortable with its back to the wall, that they've been in the opposition for the better part of 80 plus years. So in some sense, they were returning to their natural state of being the ones who were resisting patiently, and they were going to stay in this in the Rabah Square until their rights were recognized. And there was a sense that they would wait as long as it took. And they were in these protest sites for quite some time. So we're talking about July 3rd to August 14th, where Egypt is on edge and no one knows how this is going to be resolved because there are two competing sources of legitimacy in the same capital city.
Was Morsi already in prison at this point?
Yes, he was basically incommunicado almost immediately after the coup on July 3rd, where he was taken, basically. And not just Morsi, but much of the senior leadership was arrested in the subsequent months. By the time of late 2014, so about a year after the coup, there wasn't a single senior leader of the Muslim Brotherhood who wasn't either in prison or in exile or in hiding. So in that sense, they were totally eliminated from the public space. But what was really striking to me on a personal level was to see how my family in Egypt was reacting both before the massacre and after the massacre. But before all this happened, the hysteria was something we saw on the popular level in the kind of pro-military media. But to kind of see people that you love and that are dear to you and that you've known for a long time just kind of lose their minds, crazy.
What do you mean by that?
Just this desire for blood, a bloodlust. My family was not involved in any of this, but they wanted other people to kill members and leaders of the Brotherhood. And they knew what was happening, maybe not during the massacre, but as it became clear what had happened. They didn't have any problem with the basic premise of Brotherhood members being killed en masse. But even in the lead up to it, I remember one of my uncles who publicly called for the execution of Muslim Brotherhood leaders without due process. And he felt a need to kind of emphasize that there shouldn't be any proceedings or courts. They should just be killed wherever you can find them. Like, these are people who don't deserve a hearing. They are an existential threat to everything, as he saw it, Egypt was or should be. And in kind of existential conflict, you kill. I mean, that was something I hadn't seen before.
After the massacre, Morsi stays in jail. Is his death going to have an impact on the political future of the Muslim Brotherhood, or is it more this question of the removal of all of the Muslim Brotherhood leadership?
I think that I see his death as a reminder of something that was lost, not because Morsi was a good man. I think he was a pretty lousy president, and he did have an authoritarian streak, and the Brotherhood did overstep during its time in power. But it was a reminder, and this goes back to your question about what was the year of Morsi actually like. There was this freewheeling marketplace of ideas. Egypt was alive. The country was extremely polarized, but people were able to express their opinions for the most part without fear of persecution. There were mass protests on a regular basis, including oftentimes against the Muslim Brotherhood, against Morsi. There was freedom. I had never seen that level of freedom in Egypt. That's not because of Morsi. It's because there was a democratic transition in place. What Morsi might symbolize, even though he himself wasn't a particularly successful or remarkable or effective person, both as president but also before president, that he was a symbol of what Egypt could have been.
It's less to do with the man himself. It's less to do with whether he was an effective leader, an adept leader, whether he was charismatic, which you've established that he was not. It's less to do with what he was able to implement. But the symbolism of a democratically elected leader who was sitting in office with at least the will of some of the people, implementing an imperfect democratic system in its infancy, which is crushed before it's allowed to grow.
Exactly. But also, that if you think about the circumstances of his death now several years later, Morsi was in a sense forgotten. And this also speaks to the fact that he wasn't someone that Brotherhood members felt necessarily very inspired by or very close to. So he wasn't the most effective rallying point for the Brotherhood in opposition and in exile after the coup. But also the fact that the world moved on, in a sense, the way Morsi was forgotten as an individual, Egypt and its potential of what it could have been has also been forgotten. A lot of us have accepted that, you know, Egypt is Egypt. There's a brutal dictator in power, and people have come to terms with that.
And now you get up to this point where just before Morsi's death, the Trump administration considers actually putting the Muslim Brotherhood on the list of banned terrorist organizations. It seems like that's been backburnered, but that conversation to go from Morsi being the democratically elected president, imperfect, and a member of the Muslim Brotherhood to a conversation about banning the Muslim Brotherhood, what does that mean?
It makes it an even more remarkable fall from grace. People can hate the Brotherhood ideologically, and that's perfectly fine because there's many things the Brotherhood believes that I think we as Americans would see as extremely problematic. But believing in a democratic process means that you have to accommodate the role of actors like the Muslim Brotherhood to some degree.
In the years since the crackdown, in the years since the Rabaa massacre, what are interpersonal relationships like in Egypt? Are people fearful in a way that they weren't?
Under Mubarak, you had, if you will, a kind of normal repression. It was bad, but it was like, it wasn't particularly unusual. What you see under Sisi is a completely different level. So I don't actually like it when people compare Sisi to Mubarak because it's not actually doing Sisi justice in terms of his propensity for very, very high levels of repression. I would put it on the level of kind of like the Syrias and the Saudi Arabias in terms of like very unforgiving levels of repression, which affects families. And that, so the fact that families have been torn apart, I know a number of people in exile where their parents or their brothers or sisters turned against them and said, you're a terrorist. You support a terrorist organization. We're not going to support you. And they won't speak to each other. So you're seeing a depoliticization of Egyptian public space where people have retreated away from any kind of public political debate. There is no politics in Egypt today. Egypt, in some sense, has become a dead country. There is no movement. It is not alive.
That was Shadi Hamid, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He's also the author of Islamic Exceptionalism, How the Struggle Over Islam is Reshaping the World. First Person is produced by me, Sarah Wildman, along with Benjamin Soloway and Maya Gandhi. Our editor is Rob Sachs, and our executive editor for news and podcasts is Dan Efron. We'll be back next Friday. Thanks for listening.